Welcome to Heartbeat of Humanity, a podcast series for staff and volunteers in the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement working with mental health and psychosocial support services. My name is Jesper Gule and I am a communications officer working for the IFSC Reference Center for Psychosocial Support. Today, September 10th, is World Suicide Prevention Day. Every year, 800,000 people die by suicide. A staggering number. And even more so if you consider that for each suicide, there are more than 20 suicide attempts. Every 45 seconds, someone in the world dies by suicide. But suicide can be prevented, and that is what we will talk about today. The guest in this episode is Kelly McBride, technical advisor in the IFSC Psychosocial Center and author of Suicide Prevention During COVID-19, a guide for staff and volunteers in the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement, working with suicide or self-harm prevention initiatives. So Kelly, before we start talking about suicide prevention, what are the most common causes of suicide?
Well, thanks Jesper, and I think that's a really good question because there's no one easy answer. And so suicide, you know, can impact people for a number of reasons. And so we're looking at a combination of things like genetics, like psychological backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, societal risk factors, traumatic experiences. All of these things can come together and make someone more at risk for suicide. As you mentioned, the numbers are staggering. We're talking about, 16 million attempts per year. So it's really important, I think, today that we're talking about this and maybe exploring some of the reasons, but the long answer to your question is there's no one single cause. We can look at different things like the links between mental disorders. So depression, alcohol use, those links have been well established in high income countries, but there's not as much data in low middle income countries. But we can also think about the other kind of situations in which suicide occur, and sometimes they can be sort of sudden moments of crisis. So maybe financial disruptions, maybe relationships being, breakups, things like that, chronic pain, conflict, disaster, violence, stressful life events and loss. All of these can contribute to people perhaps thinking about suicide or, making attempts on their own lives.
So who are most at risk?
And so this is another no short answer because it's different across the board. And so it varies among communities. And this is why it's so important when we talk about suicide prevention that we include community members, those with lived experiences, those who are actually in the context to help us to know exactly what those kind of, we call them risk factors, which are the things that would make someone more maybe vulnerable or more prone to think about suicide. And so in general, we know a few things. The kind of number one contributor is someone who's already had an attempt at suicide. We know that having family members, close ones to us who have attempted suicide, that's also something that can put us at risk. Psychiatric disorders, those who have been, exposed, as we mentioned before, conflict, violence, alcohol and substance use. There's just a lot of different risk factors we can explore. Hopelessness, it's going to kind of vary, I think, among our contexts and our communities. And so, again, this is why engaging our community, but also just being aware that risk factors can happen at an individual level, they can happen at a community level, and they can happen at a societal level.
So what do you mean by that? It could be an individual level, community or national level, what does that mean?
Good question. So there might be things, for example, within the larger context, for example, not having access to mental health care or mental health treatment, that can serve as a kind of a structural barrier and can serve as something that can put someone more at risk. So if they are feeling, like they need support, if they are thinking about suicide, if there's no good treatment option, that can serve as a risk factor. On individual level, we know that things like, and it kind of ties into that kind of community societal level, but job loss, for example, during COVID-19 and during previous economic kind of downfalls and collapses, we've, when job loss is at a very large level and our access to earning an income is impacted, that impacts our lives. And so that can also, I think, serve as a contributing factor or risk factor on a more individual level. If we can also think about chronic stress or chronic pain, feelings of hopelessness. These are all different things that we call risk factors. And, you know, it might look different between adults than children. Adults and children are obviously very different in the way that they behave and the way that they express things. And so, again, it's kind of no one size fits all, you know, I guess, formula for who is at risk. And so it's really important that suicide prevention efforts are geared towards creating an environment where a person does feel safe and comfortable, and stigma is reduced as much as possible so that what could be a risk factor on an individual level can be explored kind of in a safe way, and so that there's space to talk about these different things as well as protective factors. So we talk a lot about risk factors, so what makes someone maybe more at risk of it, but protective factors are also really important for us to explore. And so I mentioned before having access to mental health treatment. So that's really important, having a sense of belonging in your community, you know, positive coping strategies, being able to lend help to others, having a positive self-image. All of these are what we call protective factors. And it's almost that counterbalance to risk factor. And so it's really important when we're thinking about suicide prevention, we're keeping this word prevention really at heart and knowing that there's many things that we can do to kind of build resilience and to build up kind of these supports, internal supports and external supports in people's lives to hopefully prevent, you know, more attempts or more suicides from occurring.
I remember one of the things you wrote about in your guide, Suicide Prevention During COVID-19, is how we talk about suicide, the wording. Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, that one's really important. And something that I don't know that immediately comes to mind, especially when we think about films and when we think about the way that suicide is talked about. I'll give you an example. The language, so to commit suicide, that language, the word commit, implies that someone has done something wrong, unlawful. And that in itself is really stigmatizing. And so that's one example of the kind of language that we use that can kind of increase barriers or increase stigma against suicide. And so using language, you know, like attempt suicide or language that those with lived experience endorse is really, I think, critical to how we're thinking about suicide prevention. And so we can talk about, you know, the ways in which helpers talk about suicide and, you know, making sure that they're talking in non-judgmental ways. But also our media plays a really big role in this. I talked about films a moment ago. The way that suicide is portrayed in films, ensuring that we're not sensationalizing when a suicide does happen within our community, because we also know that that in itself can create another risk factor. Unfortunately, when suicides occur in a community, there can be kind of copycat situations. And so making sure that we're working with actors in the community to create safe, non-judgmental language in ways that we're doing everything we can to destigmatize suicide, because it's actually, you know, as the statistics show, it's quite common that, you know, particularly when we think about thoughts of suicide, that's quite a normal, common thing to happen. And so the more we can kind of create safety around how we talk about it, the more likely people might be to reach out for help and for support.
And when we talk about suicide prevention, a key step in preventing suicide is to identify if someone is at risk of suicide. How do you do that?
Also a really good question. And just to kind of put a disclaimer that this isn't meant to be, you know, a training session. And definitely, you know, ensuring that, you know, trained professionals or trained providers have the capacity to identify and respond. But there are some things that we can look for, and everyone plays a role. So it's not just healthcare providers that play a role in suicide prevention. And so everyone from you and I supporting our friends and loved ones to community leaders, teachers, what we call kind of community gatekeepers, all the way up to, you know, trained healthcare professionals. There's a lot that can be done to be aware of kind of those, you know, warning signs that someone might be at risk. And again, like everything else, it's not a one-size-fits-all formula. Someone can be walking around, you know, smiling, you know, laughing. Everything seems really normal, and they could be thinking of suicide. But, you know, it is important that we are training people. So within the healthcare systems, within the community and our awareness building efforts, that we do provide information about what some of those signs can be. And so some of the general things that we can look out for are people who are maybe becoming withdrawn or disengaged from their work, from activities that maybe brought them meaning before. So maybe withdrawing from their friends or hobbies, things like that. Putting their affairs in order. So making sure all of their kind of bank accounts are sorted. Their personal effects are in order. Calling people, saying their goodbyes obviously might be an important one to think about. But we can also consider really strong feelings of hopelessness and people who, you know, when we're talking and engaging with them, maybe aren't really expressing that they see any future for themselves or any way out of their situation. That can also be a red flag. Also kind of mood changes. So if we have these sort of extreme mood changes where people are going from really depressed to really happy, that can also be, if we've got some of these other, things in place, that can also be a bit of a warning sign for us. And so I think it's really important that while we're thinking about identifying that we're training, you know, if when we're talking about healthcare settings or suicide prevention, more formal settings, we're talking about being able to listen for these different elements. So being able to create that space where someone, for example, if they're calling or if they're seeing their healthcare provider just for a basic, you know, appointment, that a healthcare provider might be aware and able to listen for those signs, that perhaps someone is feeling really low, and doesn't see, much hope for a future, and that they know how to kind of sensitively have a conversation. And then also talking about, beyond healthcare settings, but anyone who's really, I would say suicide prevention is something that we can all collectively contribute to. And so if you are engaging, different activities, maybe MHPSS activities or child protection activities, or, you know, if we're talking about like the humanitarian sector, but in, you know, in school and education settings, it's really important that we are training people to kind of at least be aware of some of these basic warning signs and things to look out for, and that they know how to refer out to more specialized supports. And so we can talk about that as well, kind of how to respond. But I think that identification is just really one of those key crucial things, and then creating a supportive environment to explore and then maybe help connect people to additional supports.
Early on, when we talked about causes of suicide, you made a distinction between adults and children. What if we talk about identifying if somebody is at risk of suicide? Are the signals the same or are they also different?
Between adults and children?
Yes.
Some of the signals can be similar, but in youth, there's different things that we can look out for, including, if there's a history of abuse in the house, that goes for adults as well. If there's bullying happening, If there's, and this is something really important to mention, I think that happens for both groups, is looking at, you know, if there's access to lethal means as well. And then, you know, the feelings of shame and hopelessness and humiliation and loss. And, you know, adults and children might be quite different in how they express things. In my experience, sometimes the words aren't necessarily there when you're younger. You might not know how to say it, and same for adults, but creating spaces for, you know, conversations that can involve drawing or play and things like that to kind of help facilitate the expression of things. And again, it's not really a one size fits all. And the differences aren't necessarily that stark between what would make a youth versus an adult at risk. It's maybe more a difference in kind of the expression of how they would talk to you and how they would tell you about it. And that's, again, why it's so important to have people like teachers or like community leaders that are able to kind of, you know, identify those signs, to have those conversations, and just to be aware, maybe of behavioral changes, things like that. If a child, you know, changes from maybe being, you know, pretty chill and relaxed to maybe being more impulsive or aggressive, for example, that could be something to explore a little bit. But, you know, looking again at the protective factors. And that's incredibly important with youth and adults, but, you know, creating spaces to support families, supportive caregivers and supportive adults really do play a key role. And they're the ones that can also identify if there are changes, if their child's becoming more withdrawn or kind of talking about things in a really hopeless way, or being kind of fixated on death is also something else. That might come up. So maybe in their drawings or something like that, death is becoming a more common theme. And so the adults in their lives play a really key role. And then again, the access to mental health care and the access to supports is really important, and something that, you know, we don't always see in all of the contexts that we're working in. But as much as possible, building the capacity of the healthcare system to not only address suicide and suicidal behaviors and self-harm behaviors within adults, but having them be equipped to work with children, which I think is a bit of a different specialty in itself, or a different art in its own.
And whether you are a staff or volunteer in the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, or you are a colleague or a friend or family member, if you identify some of these signals, how do you respond?
Yeah. And so again, you know, we talked a little bit about the fact that kind of everyone has a role that they can play in suicide prevention. And so there's sort of different levels to be aware of. And, you know, I would say that, you know, looking at the different levels of how we can provide support. So at the very kind of community-based level of making sure that we're not being judgmental or creating spaces where suicidal thoughts are and behaviors or attempts are stigmatized. And so within communities, some of our communities, you know, it's punishable by law if you attempt suicide. And so just on an advocacy level, working with our ministries of health, working with our communities, working with our media to create communities that reduce stigma, that have policies that are supportive and preventative, is really key and crucial. And then kind of the next level is looking at our healthcare systems, making sure that staff, you know, that we are training healthcare providers to respond in safe ways. And so that's another thing that's not always the case in some of the environments that we're working in. In some of our environments, it can be harmful to refer individuals to hospitals or psychiatric facilities. And so doing awareness building, doing training, making sure that healthcare workers have the capacity to manage these types of crises when they do occur, and to respond in a way that, again, is non-judgmental, that is ensuring that you're looking at individuals, both their risk factors, but also their protective factors. You know, being able to assess risk is really important with trained professionals or trained volunteers. And again, this is something that you should be trained on. But being able to understand if someone is having these thoughts, what they are exactly, and being able to ask questions around, you know, do they have access to a lethal means? Do they have a plan? If they do have a plan, do they know when, where, how? Being able to explore these details is really, really important, because how you'll respond depends on what, you know, what the response is and what the answers are. And so, of course, anytime, and this goes for everyone, anytime there is an emergency situation. So if you know someone has, for example, used poison or pesticides, which is, you know, one of our, I believe the statistic is 20% of deaths by suicide are through pesticides and poisons and such. And so if you know that someone has maybe ingested something, or if they've used a lethal means against themselves, ensuring that you are contacting a healthcare provider, contacting your emergency facilities right there in the moment, if it is an emergency, you know, situation. If it's, you know, something where the risk is imminent, where someone expresses, you know, that they do have a plan and they do have intention to act on it. You know, there's a lot of things that we can do, but as a staff member, as a volunteer, being sure that you don't leave that person alone if they've expressed that is really important. And so even if you do need a bit of support, just asking, you know, would it be okay if I called my supervisor, if I called my colleague to help support me through this, if you're someone that's in this situation and you're not quite sure how to respond. Removing lethal means is really important. So making sure that you're in a safe environment. And that can be both physically safe, but also a space that feels safe to talk about what's going on. And then safety planning is something as well. A recent study came out actually kind of highlighting that safety planning is effective, which is nice, because I think safety planning has often played a key role in suicide prevention, but it's nice to you know, find or have more research supporting it. But safety planning is when you work with an individual to help them to decide, you know, or to understand for themselves maybe what puts them at risk. What are the signs that maybe they're reaching a situation where they're not feeling safe for themselves? Working with them to understand what they can do to cope, what works for them to maybe, you know, feel better on the inside, for lack of better words, or who they can talk to, who they can call, a place they can go to, somewhere that they feel safe and supported. You know, identifying, you know, different resources within the community is really important. Having this all kind of listed down, identifying if there are means for them to cause harm and working with them to remove that means. And then having those kind of numbers, or having really concrete people or hotlines that they can reach out to if they are at risk. So this is all kind of what goes into safety planning. And so that's also something that we can do to respond to risk. And then just on a, I guess, community level, again, we're looking at raising awareness about suicide, doing what we can to destigmatize it. Peer supports play a really big role. And so those with lived experiences, whether, you know, they themselves have attempted, or loved ones, you know, creating supports for individuals of the community who have been affected, for them to have space to talk through and work through anything that they're they might be feeling, but also including these groups in suicide prevention efforts, which is really, really key. So this is, again, this idea of including people with lived experiences in suicide prevention efforts. And, you know, if it, just on a very basic human level, if someone you know is thinking about suicide, being a supportive friend, being a supportive colleague, and then helping to know in your communities where you can safely refer people to, which, you know, unfortunately, not all of our contexts have hotlines, for example. But some of our contexts do have hotlines that have trained people who are there on the other side to listen and to help link and refer you. But yeah, I think just, I think at every level, just ensuring that as much as we can, raise awareness, help people to understand what the warning signs or what the risk factors might be, and then helping people to know then if you're in a caring profession, if you're a staff and volunteer, you don't have to be trained in all of the things. You shouldn't be trained in all of the things necessarily, but you should know how to refer. So finding a safe healthcare facility, for example, finding a safe community support, knowing what that next entry point is for someone to get additional support and care is really, really important.
And what if you yourself have thoughts of self-harm or suicide? What should you do?
That is a very good question, and something that is very real. And so it's a bit difficult to talk about on a, you know, on a podcast such as this that does have a global, kind of a global reach. But I would say that in general, having thoughts of suicide is something that many, many people experience, and you're not alone. And so reaching out to people that you feel safe talking to. So maybe it's a friend, maybe it's a teacher, maybe it's a parent or a loved one. Maybe it's someone at your church or mosque or on your sports team. Talking to people that you feel safe talking to about it. If your community does have supports, you know, mental health supports, things like that, that's really important. Talk to your doctor. Support is there, and suicide is preventable. And so while you might feel like the only person in the world that's having these thoughts and feelings, you're not. And so, again, it's a bit tricky because not all of our environments have safe and supportive places. But oftentimes we do have maybe one person that we might feel safe talking to. So I would encourage at the very least connecting with someone that you do trust, and then you know, reaching out if you can for more support.
Thank you, Kelly, to come and talk about this important but also difficult topic. You have been listening to Heartbeat of Humanity, a podcast series for Red Cross, Red Crescent Movement staff and volunteers about mental health and psychosocial support. In this episode, commemorating World Suicide Prevention Day, technical advisor Kelly McBride explained how suicide can be prevented. You can find her guide, Suicide Prevention During COVID-19, on the IFSC Psychosocial Center website, along with other resources about mental health and psychosocial support. Resources include manuals, webinars, policy documents, program materials, educational videos, and information about upcoming trainings, workshops, and events. My name is Jesper Gule, and I hope you enjoyed listening to this Heartbeat of Humanity podcast. Remember that mental health matters.